white shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Coral, the Sphinx.
Can't you buy our whole dress?
Coral, the Sphinx. Great gowns. Coral, beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Coral,
no, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to another episode of the Every Outfit Podcast. Chelsea, how you doing?
I'm good. How is this Airbnb going for you? I don't know why I find it so weird seeing you in here.
You are staring at me behind a turned over mattress. We talked about this on a previous episode. We've converted a bedroom into our recording studio.
This was a bedroom? I'm sorry, this is not big enough to qualify as a bedroom anywhere other than New York City.
I originally rented this place because it showed that this room was an office, and then downstairs, what was an office, was empty. And I was like, perfect, Paul and I can each have our own spaces. And then we came here and this was a bedroom and I went, fuck. But actually, this is perfect because this bed and mattress is sucking up the sound in this hollow, hollow Airbnb.
Yeah, these walls do seem a little thin.
You have one of two options, it seems, as a millennial. You can buy an older home where everything is wrong with it because it was built 50 years ago and the old owners did not maintain anything, which is how you are able to buy it. Or you can buy new construction and everything is fucking hollow because they've chosen the cheapest things. This is what exists today.
Yeah, I love that these potted plants in here just still have the IKEA stickers on them.
Everything is IKEA down to the flatware. It's like, could you have not gone to CB2? I mean, not to pay my own money, but I'll use like credit card points just to buy them better flatware and like leave it for the next guest. What have you been up to? Obviously, my life is boring as fuck. I think you have had a much more interesting week than mine.
Well, yes, I did go to the Pornhub Awards. That was fun. It was at Whiskey A Go-Go, which is, I guess, where every party is now randomly. I don't really get that, but it was so fun. And I think it's the only award show that I could go to where it's like, I literally don't know who anyone is. Like, Sasha Grey was the last porn star who I was on like a name and face basis with.
Post Stoya, James Dean, Sasha Grey.
I don't know what's happened, but I was there to support my friend Queenie Sateen, who was nominated. Shout out to Queenie. She's a fuckette and arguably the Carrie Bradshaw of the adult entertainment industry. Lots of vintage Dior and Cavalli.
Ooh.
And she looked amazing, but tragically lost. She was robbed.
The music industry is suffering. If we're the ones playing music venues and porn awards are at the Whiskey A Go-Go, like, where are musicians performing?
I know, right? Also, it was so campy because they had a step and repeat, of course, but it was like an orange carpet because it was Pornhub and Kelly Catrone was manning the carpet and like screaming at people. And I was just so happy to see a New York woman out here. I miss them. Julia Fox was also there, another iconic New Yorker.
A little surprised that this didn't happen in Vegas, but I do like that, you know, we're bringing porn back to LA.
Exactly. But it was so fun. Like, the categories were so fun because it was like best twink, best MILF, best squirter. They didn't like announce all of them, but we got to see who won each category.
Oh, so it's like the Emmys and the Schmemmys. There's like a technical side where it's like, you know what? This isn't even worthy of announcing on stage. We'll just tell you who won.
No, I feel like they actually only announced like 5 awards and the rest was just sort of expressed to us in montage form. Also, I knew that Rick Ross was performing. I just assumed he was going to do a couple songs or like a medley of his greatest hits. Guys, I went to a whole ass Rick Ross concert. Like, he performed for at least a half an hour, maybe 45 minutes. Like, I saw all of the songs.
Can we get an early 2000s Bravo rotation back? Like, can we get Kel on Earth? Because I need behind the scenes of this party.
Totally. But the crowd was very fun. Like, you would think that it would be a bunch of like hot female porn stars and a bunch of like sketchy guys, but the crowd was very mixed. Lots of queer people, lots of trans people. Good vibes, but some wild bodies, I have to say. Like, squished into like mesh Gautier dresses.
It sounds like a Cronenberg film as you describe it. Shall we get into some hot topics?
Sure.
We would be remiss if we didn't announce, as of April 1st, and this wasn't an April Fool's Day joke, Sex and the City is now available to watch on Netflix. We all have all of the streaming platforms, and those platforms stream their shows on other streaming platforms. Like, of course Sex and the City has migrated from Max to Netflix.
It just feels wrong to watch it on Netflix, though, because I feel like I've been brainwashed almost into associating Sex and the City with HBO for like over 20 years now. I can't even comprehend watching Sex and the City without thinking about the little static part with the HBO.
We can't even have HBO on Max anymore, right? They dropped the HBO.
This is HBO erasure.
I love that the big online take is like, oh boy, wait until Gen Z gets to the bisexual episode or like the transsexual sex worker episode.
Oh, right, because they're all bisexual and trans.
I guess my point is like, does Gen Z not have Max? Like, they were seeming able to find girls a year ago and attach themselves to that show.
Also, to our Gen Z listeners, we're not talking about you.
No.
We obviously know you watch Sex and the City and are very culturally literate.
Chell, can I just read you the worst thing that I saw on TikTok? This is related to Gen Z and girls, if I may. I'm watching Girls on HBO for the first time and I realize I wasn't meant to be 23 in this age. I was meant to be a 23-year-old hipster living in Brooklyn in 2012 wearing too many floral patterns, listening to Vampire Weekend and writing absurd listicles on BuzzFeed while it was at its peak. I'm a converted millennial apologist now because what a time to be alive.
It really was not that great.
Last year was the first year I felt old and like to see shit like that, I'm like, oh God. No, we're the old ones now.
We're really old. I'm almost 40. Like, this shit is crazy. I've lived a whole ass life. I don't remember half of it, but you know, c'est la vie.
Yeah, we've gotten to a place where I remember living in New York and being told by older people, like, oh, you miss the boat on when New York was good. And now it's like, oh, we have a younger generation looking at the time we lived in New York. It was like, no, that was the time to have lived in New York.
I think that when we first moved to New York, so what would that have been, like 2003, 2004?
2006 for me, but yes.
Yeah, I moved in 2003. You could still smoke in bars when I moved there. So that was a different era of New York for sure. And I'm glad that I was there for it, frankly. It did feel like the last gasp. Although New York, it's like it always like regenerates or something. New York exists in cycles.
It's true, but I do feel like a demarcation point was when CBGBs no longer existed.
Not only did it no longer exist, it was turned into a John Varvatos store, which just made it extra campy.
Which it remains a John Varvatos store. Don't know who shops there, but whatever.
I think only John Varvatos himself and the people in his ads, like those are the only people that shop there.
And Howard Stern. That's the only other person I know who wears John Varvatos. There's nothing like the feeling of being confident in your own skin. That's why I'm excited to tell you about today's sponsor, OneSkin. Their products make it easy to keep your skin healthy while looking and feeling your best. No complicated routine, no multi-step protocols, just simple, scientifically validated solutions. I personally have fallen out of love with a 20-step skincare routine. I'll leave that for the preteens. Honestly, I've realized the less complicated, the better. OneSkin really is science-backed skincare. They combine tissue engineering, data analysis, and cutting-edge longevity science to create the world's most effective product to target skin aging. The secret is OneSkin's proprietary OS-01 peptide. It's the first ingredient proven to switch off the aging cells that cause lines, wrinkles, and thinning skin. And they've got several studies to back it up. Also, their packaging is so minimal and chic. I'm in love. I've been using their cleanser as well as their OS-01 face topical supplement for a minute now. And honestly, I've been leaning on it heavily on this tour. It has kept my skin plump and glowing when really, I'm just haggard and very tired. But don't just take my word for it. OneSkin has over 4,000 five-star reviews and were recognized by Fast Company as one of the most innovative brands in 2024. OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company. By focusing on the cellular aspects of aging, OneSkin keeps your skin looking and acting younger for longer. Get started today with 15% off using code OUTFIT at oneskin.co. That's 15% off at oneskin.co with code OUTFIT. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them that we sent you. You've heard me talk about my love of Quince before, how they transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach. Are you like me, and now that the temperatures are getting warmer, you're looking to upgrade your summer wardrobe? Perhaps with a premium European linen dress, blouse, and short, or maybe a washable silk top? Personally, I've had my eye on this linen scoop neck midi dress in black gingham. With Quince, the dress is a fraction of the cost it would be anywhere else. How do they do this, you may ask? Well, Quince pairs directly with top factories. They cut out the cost of the middleman and pass the savings on to all of us. Honestly, there's so much good stuff in their new linen collection. There's also this linen strapless top that's giving season 2 carry vibes. A must get, in my opinion. There's also a pajama set that's giving the perfect spring work from home vibes, if your work is being a degenerate podcaster like me. Wow, this is just turning into my own personal wish list from Quince. Best yet, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. Quince has it all: clothing, home goods, jewelry that are timeless at an unbeatable price. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/outfit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/outfit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/outfit. I was on Twitter searching Sex and the City and Netflix, as you do, and I found this QAnon tweet that really has connected everything, Chell. Are you ready for it?
Yeah.
Sex and the City is the header of Netflix today. In the first episode, Kim Cattrall says Mr. Big is the next Donald Trump in New York City. Mr. Big died in the last season of Sex and the City of a heart attack. Donald Trump posted on True Social April Fool's Day an image of his casket and red roses.
Wow.
So Donald Trump is going to die of a heart attack?
That wouldn't be the craziest way for him to die.
No, but that man has been nowhere near a Peloton. There is not a single Peloton in Mar-a-Lago. Not even the Peloton treadmill.
And honestly, good for him. He just needs to be himself. True. We don't want him to be ripped like Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, that is quite upsetting. Did you see the photo of Mark Zuckerberg in Japan making his own sword?
No, but how embarrassing. Anyway, Shakira? Shakira doesn't like Barbie.
Shakira and her sons don't like Barbie. So yes, this quote has been going around where she was asked for reasons her opinion on the movie Barbie. She goes, "I watched it, yeah. And my sons absolutely hated it. They felt that it was emasculating. And I agree to a certain extent. I'm raising two boys. I want them to feel powerful too while respecting women. I like pop culture when it attempts to empower women without robbing men of their possibility to be men, to also protect and provide. I believe in giving women all the tools and the trust that we can do it all without losing our essence, without losing our femininity. I think that men have a purpose in society and women have another purpose as well. We complement each other and that compliment should not be lost."
There are poles and we're holes, and it's as simple as that.
This comes from an interview in Allure, and I was like, I gotta know the context. Like, why is this interviewer asking her opinion about a film that came out 10 months ago?
Fair for her sons to hate it. Like, I would hate the Transformers movie if I saw it because it's not for me. Like, if I was a little boy, I'd be like, "Mom, that fucking sucked."
Yeah, I guess they must have seen Ryan Gosling and they were like, "This movie's for me," but it's not.
Look, I'm sure a lot of people feel this way. I don't think this is an unpopular opinion to have. It's just the kind of thing that a celebrity can't really say out loud to a journalist without getting a lot of backlash. But I don't think this film robs men of their possibility to be men. It's just in the world of Barbie, no one gives a fuck about Ken. And that's true because little girls just don't care about Ken. It's not that deep.
To go back to your point in the Transformer films, no one gave a fuck about Megan Fox, so much so that they replaced her in the second movie, the third movie.
Also, I feel like I've been watching like flagrantly sexist movies for as long as I've had consciousness, and you don't hear me complaining about it. I feel like Shakira should be able to watch one movie with the word patriarchy.
I went back to this article because I was like, what is the context? Like, what prompted her to give this whole monologue? Really her own America Ferrara monologue, but in reverse about what it's like to be a woman. So it's prompted because she goes, "I heard by 2030, 60% of the world's wealth will be managed by women." And then the interviewer is like, "Now I can't help but ask a question that's been on my mind since we began this conversation. Did you watch the movie Barbie?"
Yeah, that's weird. I don't know. I just like don't subscribe to this belief that like men can't be men anymore and women can't be women anymore because everyone's so PC. It's like up to an individual to decide how much you want to play into those gender roles and those gender dynamics. Like, no one's stopping you.
Yeah, something tells me that this is not going to stop Shakira's sons from being men.
It's just that, like, a lot of people, like, didn't relate to the whole, like, women are soft feminine nurturers and men are, like, rugged protectors. So obviously, like, now we're seeing films that have different perspectives about gender roles, but whatever. I don't care that Shakira doesn't like Barbie.
I'm fine with it.
Liking Barbie shouldn't be a metric for whether you're a feminist or not.
It's feeling like the equivalent of, like, who'd you vote for in 2020? It's like, did you like Barbie or not? So, hot on the heels of its 25th anniversary, Warner Brothers announced yesterday that they will be blessing us with a fifth Matrix film, except this time, none of the Wachowskis are involved. Instead, writer-director Drew Goddard will be writing and directing this fifth Matrix.
See, this was really shocking to me because I was unaware that there was a third and fourth Matrix. I saw the first one and didn't feel the need to go further down the latex rabbit hole.
You didn't follow the white rabbit? That's always bothered me about the Matrix, of like, that is such a fake white rabbit tattoo on that girl's shoulder.
See, I don't even know that reference. I like the fashions, though.
Lily Wachowski wrote and directed a sequel called Matrix Resurrections, which I also did not see. But from what I understand, it was a comment on reboot culture, almost like she saw this coming.
So it was like Scream 5 or Scream.
Yes. So the quote from the studio is, "Drew came to Warner Brothers with a new idea that we all believe would be an incredible way to continue the Matrix world by honoring what Lana and Lily began over 25 years ago and offering a unique perspective based on his own love of the series and the characters."
So are Matrix purists, like, furious, or are they into this? Like, I have no idea who this man is that's making this.
Drew Goddard comes from the writer's room of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. He wrote The Martian. He's a sci-fi guy. I feel like the only way to do a sequel to The Matrix, quite like what David Gordon Green did with Halloween, which is like, fuck all the other sequels. This is actually just a sequel to the first Matrix.
Yeah. Look, I think you should see all three of those Matrix movies in a single day. I actually did that with Twilight. I saw three of them in a 24-hour period because I agreed to go with my friend to see the third one in the theater. And then I was like, oh, I guess I have to watch the first two now.
I'll do it. Let's see if this film even comes out. I did not realize that Easter, Transvisibility Day, and the 25th anniversary of The Matrix all fell on the same day, which is quite poetic, as The Matrix is a Jesus allegory written by two trans women.
It does feel like the stars aligned for that one.
I feel like we should do a time lapse of me watching all three of them. I'll give a refresh for everyone.
So we had Lizzo in the doc because she announced that she was quitting music, but she's already unquit music?
Yeah, in a video that she posted Tuesday, she was like, oh, when I say I quit, I mean I quit giving any negative energy attention. What I'm not going to quit is the joy of my life, which is making music, which is connecting the people. I don't even want to discuss this. Either quit or suffer in silence. It feels like she was saying on a Sunday, I'm quitting the business. And on Monday, all of her reps had to talk to her. And then on Tuesday, she was like, no, when I say I quit, I mean I'm quitting bad feelings.
Yeah, that lasted for an even shorter amount of time than La Roche's retirement from styling.
To be fair, he said he was never giving up Zendaya as a client. So he got us there.
Look, I understand why Lizzo's like over it. Like, being canceled sucks. Being famous sucks. And just because of her body, she's criticized way more than, like, your average celebrity. Actually, probably more than any celebrity in that department. So I get it. Like, you would just go crazy at a certain point. But I really think that celebrities should be banned from posting, like, text-based grid posts on Instagram, like Notes app vibes.
We can't help it. We are our own social media managers, so we have to have Instagram on our phones. But if I was that level famous, I'd be like, just filter. Just tell me like five nice comments a week.
Well, also, if I was a celeb, I would do that thing where it's like only people I follow can comment on my posts.
If J-Lo can exist with this onslaught of criticism she has faced nonstop for 2 months, Lizzo can do it too. Like, if J-Lo's not quitting, she had to rebrand her tour, Chelsea. She went from This Is Me Now to This Is Me Live, The Greatest Hits.
I would need reassurance that this wouldn't be like her version of the Renaissance tour, but with that album.
that it wasn't just going to be Dear Ben 2.
Anyway, speaking of albums, shall we talk about Cowboy Carter?
Oh, wait, were we supposed to listen to that?
Are you kidding? Did you not?
Of course okay. I did.
Why did I fall for that? I'm a fucking idiot. What do you think about Cowboy Carter?
I like it. I mean, I think it's good. I think it works as a Beyonce album. I think it works as a country album, as far as I understand that to mean. And I think it works as contemporary music.
I think it's a fun album. I've been listening to it all week. I do have criticisms. The weird thing about this album, it's like listening to a soundtrack to a film that you haven't seen.
Yes.
Like, there's so much storytelling involved in this album. There's a lot to digest. There's so many samples and interpolations and, you know, artists that are on this album. It's just, it's a lot. But I'm into it. I think it's a fascinating chapter in the story of Beyonce, certainly.
It's certainly not underbaked, let's say. If anything, it's overbaked.
Yeah, it's very maximalist in general.
I think the interludes, like the under-minute songs, are kind of the most interesting things about the record.
The interludes give it a bit more of a country quality, especially the Willie Nelson and the Dolly Parton of it all.
But yeah, and this idea that it's not underbaked, it might be overcooked, is like, there are little songs that, like My Rose or Oh Louisiana, where it's like, I couldn't finish it, but it's good. It's a minute. Let's just throw it on there. And I'm like, I like this.
It's perfect for our short attention spans. I do think that compared to Renaissance, like Renaissance is an album that I listen to straight through and I do not skip things. I can anticipate skipping things on this album because I think that a lot of the songs are more there to like reinforce a narrative or tell a story than for just to be a good song.
Yeah, I feel like there are blocks of music for me where it's like I would listen to these five songs in a row. Like Linda Martell Show into Yaya into Oh Louisiana into Desert Eagle is like I could listen to those four things straight through. By the way, two of those are like interludes.
Yeah, I think I like the back half of the album more. My favorite songs are Two Most Wanted, obviously. It's weird. Like, when I think about it, all of my favorite songs on this album, they actually could be Fleetwood Mac songs. Like, I don't know if you listen to Alligator Tears,
of
but
course.
Like, how that is not a Fleetwood Mac song is insane. Also, Bodyguard, like, I can imagine Christine McVie singing that song very easily. And Two Most Wanted has a landslide interpolation of some kind in it.
Yeah, it's more 70s easy listening than anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
One of my favorite songs is Yaya.
Yes.
That's the song I've been playing over and over again. I think that's one of the strongest samples, which is Nancy Sinatra's These Boots Were Made for Walkin'. I also like the lead track American Requiem, and I would have maybe released that is one of the lead singles. Like, that's my other hot take, is I feel like there could have been a different song other than 16 Carriages to have released from this album.
Well, I feel like they released Texas Hold'em because it is the most traditionally country song on this entire record. It actually made people believe that the entire record might sound like those songs.
And I would say the most, quote unquote, Beyonce of the songs on the record is Spaghetti.
Spaghetti is great.
There's definitely a heavy like 60s and 70s influence because Spaghetti and then the song Daughter, which I think comes before Spaghetti, are references to the spaghetti western genre of film where Italian directors would direct cheap westerns in Italy. Because on Daughter, at a certain point, she begins singing in Italian with like a very spaghetti western guitar score in the background.
Yeah, I think one thing I like about this album is how unpredictable it is in many ways. Like, obviously, you could have never foreseen that she would want to make a song like that. But to your point about concepts, one of my criticisms is that like some of these songs, if you don't know the story, isn't that interesting. Like if you don't know that like Blackbird is the cover of a Beatles song that's about the civil rights movement and that she's invited all these contemporary black country artists on that song, that's almost a richer story than the song itself.
Well, that's what YouTube sleuths are for.
I mean, and this album is made for that.
Should we get into the Jolene cover now?
Sure.
Do we think it's good?
I think it's okay. I like that she changed the lyrics. I like that it's a throwback to the Lemonade era, of course, and that it fits within her personal narrative in that way. But again, it's, I think that it's almost like the novelty of Beyoncé singing Jolene is almost more interesting than the song itself. Like, I think the like 15 second snippet of I Fall to Pieces, which is at the beginning of Sweet Country Bucking, is more interesting than the totality of the Jolene cover. But that's just me.
Yeah, I would say the highlight of the Jolene cover is actually the 15 second interlude before, where Dolly Parton is like leaving a voice message for Beyonce and like, I heard there's a girl with good hair who's a bit of a hussy in your life.
Oh yeah, the Dolly stuff, that adds so much color to the album. It's so fun. And we grew up listening to hip hop albums that had full sketch comedy, essentially. Yes. Throwback to that as well.
But I like the idea that we're in this like multiverse where Jolene and Becky with the good hair exist in the same world. The best cover of Jolene is the one that Miley Cyrus did in those backyard sessions. And that's okay to say. There are just some covers that no one will ever top.
Yeah, I think my favorite Jolene cover randomly might be the White Stripes cover, because I think one thing that Beyoncé changed about that song, like, Jolene is a song about desperation. Beyoncé made it more about revenge, very much not about desperation. Whereas I think the White Stripes cover amplified the desperation to make it like I'm hitting rock bottom level dramatic. And also just having a man sing it naturally adds something new.
Well, but that's the thing. This isn't a cover of Jolene. It's like inspired by.
It's fanfic.
And it's very Beyoncé fanfic. I saw a take that was like, Beyoncé cannot let herself be a victim. Like, she always has to come from a place of power. The song Jolene in her hands is not Jolene. It's basically a woman being like, I see your game. It's not gonna work. Step off. But wasn't the whole thing that Jay-Z definitely cheated on her?
He definitely cheated on her.
So her Jolene won. I don't know why she's rewriting history.
Well, no, because like the whole fear is that the husband's gonna leave her for Jolene. Well, also like the part in this song where she's like, I understand, like, why do you be attracted to my man? And people are like posting that on Twitter with like bad photos of Jay-Z.
It's a bop, but it isn't Jolene. It makes Jolene a sore winner song is what this song sounds like.
Well, I think this Jolene, it's the kind of thing where it's like, yeah, it's fun that it's on this record. It's one of the things that makes this exciting to talk about. But I don't know if like in 5 years, I'm going to be like firing up that Jolene cover on the Spotify. I'll listen to Sweet Country Bucking. Also, I want to talk about that song because Pharrell has basically done the fashion equivalent of insider trading. He produced this song with all of these Western references. He obviously knows the concept of Beyoncé's album. He designs the Louis Vuitton men's collection so that it is hitting stores at the very moment that this album comes out. Like, that's crazy, right?
Oh, shit. I love to think that he was in a meeting with Bernard Arnault about the job, and he was like, I'm going to tell you something. I just worked with Beyoncé, and this is going to be her next album. I could design a collection, and Bernard Arnault's like, we're going to print money. The job's yours, kid.
Well, literally, it's like, this is why you hire Pharrell. This is literally it. This is the kind of thing that, like, no one but this man would do. Western clothes have been in fashion for a while now. I think it started with those Raf Simons, Calvin Klein shows, and it seems to have gotten, like, increasingly more intense as time has gone by. But now I think it is going to hit a fever pitch. And now I actually see people, like, when I go out, I'm seeing, like, full-ass cowboys.
What we have seen of Beyoncé in this era, it's more giving Crystal Connors with the early 90s
yes.
Versace looks.
Which also, I love how that kind of is the perfect outfit for Beyoncé, because it also kind of brings it back to the Renaissance era and the sort of gay club culture influences that also inspired Gianni Versace to design those, like, leather daddy cowboy outfits to begin with. But other fashion references on Cowboy Carter, Levi's jeans. Can you imagine the free PR? Not that Levi's needs it, like, they're already literally synonymous with denim in a way that no other company is, but like, what a good week to be them.
Yeah, I'm sure their social media manager was scared. They're like, oh God, why are we trending? What now? Oh, Beyoncé's talking about us. Oh, this is a great week, actually.
That song is obviously a duet with Post Malone, but I want to dig into the Miley song a little bit more because I'm so obsessed with it. she's already done 03 Bonnie and Clyde. So this concept is something that she's explored before as an artist. But this feels like the Thelma and Louise version.
Right.
That is a country western trope, this sort of classic country man-woman love song duet. And it's fun that she did that song with a woman.
Do you think we'll get a video for this?
I don't think we're getting a video. We never got a video for Renaissance. Anything on Renaissance. My theory is that when the third album comes out, we're going to get a film that's all of it. Which is actually smart because it's like when you think about it, she's done so many of these visual albums, but like not every song is like the best and like needs to have a video sequence. Where if she picked the best five songs, let's say, from each record, like this could be the greatest film of all time.
If that happens, Jennifer Lopez is gonna fucking kill herself, okay?
I hope with Miley, I hope we get a live performance.
Do you think Beyonce will make her triumphant return to the Country Music Awards?
Oh, of course. Of course.
But that performance in part and the horrible racist response that Beyonce got partially inspired this album. There is a rumored rock album coming, that this is supposed to be a trilogy.
We know it's a trilogy. We can assume that that trilogy is about horses and genres. Very present in the first two albums.
But I was trying to think, is there any other musical artist who's done a trilogy before? Like, it's done in movies, the Colors trilogy, the Before trilogy.
I love how you mentioned, like, yeah, the trilogies we care about would be those. I think most people would bring up Star Wars.
Well, I know better than to bring that up with you.
I do love that she's making concept albums, and a rock album is what I would most like to see her do. I think we got a snippet of the sort of Beyonce as young Tina Turner energy in that one song from Lemonade, Don't Hurt Yourself.
I was going to say, that's one of my favorite tracks off the album. She already worked with Jack White. Do you have other dream collabs for this potential rock album?
I imagine she's going to be leaning into a sort of Tina Turner Little Richard vibe, but I would love to see her get really dark and twisted and maybe have a PJ Harvey moment. I would love to see her cover Marianne Faithfull's Why'd You Do It. It's a scorned woman song. It fits within the narrative of Lemonade. I believe it was actually written for Tina Turner, but she thought it was too explicit. So I feel like that would be my dream for a Beyonce rock album.
For me, I think it's no surprise that if she collaborated with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, I would truly, I would collapse.
Yeah. No, I hope she gets alternative. You know she's going to sample Nine Inch Nails at the very least, or she should sample alternative artists. She should sample like Down by the Water or something.
I love if she sampled Pantera. I mean, they are they are a Texas band after all.
I'm imagining, again, this is going to be a Tina Turner vibe, but I would love to see her sample or cover like more like black, like punk new wave music, like Bow Wow Wow or X-Ray Specs or something.
Or the Bad Brains.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've run out of pop culture things to talk about this week, so I guess we'll sign off. Bye, guys.
No, we have some hotline questions. Let's play the first call.
Hi, this is Andrea from Indianapolis, and super excited about your show in New York next month. Booked my trip and doing a little research, and fun fact, City Winery is 5 minutes from Green Naphtali, where the infamous big funeral was held. So, field trip. Thanks, guys. Love you. Bye.
I love that some fuckette looked this up, but I do want to note that, like, every single Sex in the City filming location is a stone's throw from this venue.
I also like to think that if the show goes badly enough, like Carrie when she taught that dating seminar, like there's going to be 7 people left in the audience and we're like, you know what? Let's just go over to Big's funeral location. God, we really didn't talk enough about how Big's funeral happened at an art gallery in Chelsea. That wasn't Big's vibe. That wasn't Big's vibe at all. That was barely Carrie's vibe. So no, I think our answer is we won't be doing a field trip unless things go horribly awry. But thank you for that detail.
Hey, y'all, longtime listener, first time caller. I am having a really hard time understanding Billie Eilish's style. I like to think of myself as a fashionable person, but I just don't get it. Can you explain it to me? and why y'all like it, because I know y'all don't like a lot of stuff. I just feel lost and uncultured, and hopefully you can help me bridge this gap.
You know how on E! Shows they would do dramatic reenactments? I like to think that, like, if our Hotline special was filmed, it would have a dramatic reenactment of this fuckette just, like, having photos of Billie Eilish on her wall, just being like, I don't get it.
Look, it's fine if you don't like Billie Eilish's style. You don't have to like Billie Eilish's style. Billie Eilish's style is, like, deliberately divisive.
It's okay not to like Billie Eilish's style, even after we explain it to you. Like, I don't love everything she wears either, but I will always respect the fact that she has a sense of personal style that wasn't given to her by a stylist.
It might have kind of been given to her by a stylist, but she still has a sense of style that is not about looking tall, thin, and traditionally female, which I think is the most interesting thing about her.
Except that moment that she dipped into, like, old 50s glamour.
And I think that's fun that she did that, that she's not so committed to one look. But I also just like that she wears clothes that, like, don't necessarily photograph well. Because there are many things that one can wear that look incredible in person. But the second someone takes a picture of you, it's like, oh, okay, that makes you look a little wide, that this, that, the other, whatever. She doesn't give a fuck about that, which is iconic.
There hasn't been a pop star that has had this self-generated silhouette since Gwen Stefani. Like, if you saw Billie Eilish across the room, you'd be like, that's Billie Eilish. It's fun to see that silhouette interpreted through different designers, whether it's Gucci or Willy Chavarria or Chanel. Like, I find that very admirable.
I like that she's committed to this oversized look.
Look, award shows are not inviting Diane Keaton as often as they should anymore, and so this is really our only opportunity to see one female celebrity not wear a dress at an award show.
Hey, Lauren and Chelsea, I was just calling to tell you guys something that I feel like only you guys would care about or think about, but I was listening to the rest of that Chloe 70 interview where she talked about hating Los Angeles, and a different question, she talked about films she regrets not doing and, like, people she regrets not having worked with when she had the opportunity. And she says that she was asked by John Waters to be in a movie, but she turned it down, which then I got to thinking, like, well, which John Waters movie and what role? And then I was like, wait, did she turn down to be that Selma Blair role in the, like, when Selma Blair has, like, the huge tit, her character name is Ursula Utters or something like that? I'm like, is that the role that she turned down? And if that's the case, then that means that Chloe 70 was replaced by Selma Blair twice, because it was notoriously known that she turned down the role in Legally Blonde, which then also went to Selma Blair. But just wanted to call to talk about that and tell it to someone. Bye.
This fuckette is our people. By the way, I love how he's like, it's famously known that Selma Blair.
It's famously known because it was written in the New York Magazine It Girl issue, which was our Bible.
I like this caller's theory, and I'll go with it. It's hard not to imagine Chloe 70 with gigantic prosthetic breasts.
We're talking about the movie A Dirty Shame, by the way.
Oh,
we
sorry.
Should mention
yes.
that.
Which came out in 2004, but it's also especially tough to think that if that's the case, she chose to do Brown Bunny with Vincent Gallo instead of working with John Waters.
That's exactly what I thought. But also, we have to look at the time period, right? Time period that Chloe 70 was a working actress and John Waters was still making films. There are a few films that are in the center of that Venn diagram. I think she also could have been the Christina Ricci character in Pecker.
That's what I was going to say.
Or just one of the, like, kidnappers in Cecil B. Demented.
Maybe at one point he was thinking of her for the Melanie Griffith role.
She would have been way too young.
But maybe he wanted a younger actress. We don't know.
It surprises me that she would say no just because she is willing to work with crazy directors, you know, like Lars von Trier, and she's a Provincetown person like John Waters.
So I went back and watched this section of the interview, and she lists John Waters, but also Claire Denis. She goes, at the time, the timing didn't work out, and I look back at that now being like, why did I think I would be too tired to do these roles? Like, I'm 50 now. Now I'm tired. Like, I could have done all of them.
But I can see how Chloe 70 and Selma Blair would be up for the exact same roles.
I'm sure they both got clocked with, like, they're beautiful but cerebral.
Neither of them ever got, like, the sort of bombshell roles. they kind of look smarter than most actresses. Is that rude to say?
No. I mean, they look like they should be in Whit Stillman films.
Yeah.
Hi, Lauren and Chelsea. Gen Z Fuckette here. This summer, I am entering Mr. Big's world with a finance internship in New York. I know, crazy. But I was wondering if you had advice on what I should wear to look professional, but still young and stylish.
Okay, I don't think there's ever been a better time to dress like a corporate bitch, especially because just like the idea of office dressing is kind of going out of fashion. So I think you should watch the movie Working Girl and copy the outfits. Like, go really fucking hard. Get a giant blazer, get a pussy bow blouse, carry a briefcase as a purse, wear pantyhose, get some pumps, get into it.
My advice is going to be very boring, right? A couple good pants, a good blazer. Like you said, high time for corporate drag, because you no longer have to rely on like sad fast fashion or mall brand tailoring. There's like Frankie Shop, there's Massimo Dutti. They have great options, especially for the price / quality that you get. But my realistic advice is, I think playing with proportions is how you keep it corporate but still maintain your personality. So maybe a wider, baggier pinstripe pant with a cropped blazer, or you do an oversized blazer with a tighter leg pant.
I think the thing is getting separates that are very anonymous and interchangeable. Button-down shirts, you need slacks, you know, a pencil skirt if you're going for she-her vibes. Ideally, you should invest in a pair of loafers, ideally Prada.
Basically, what we're trying to tell you is don't do whatever cosplay Carrie was doing when she visited Big's office in season 4 to hit him up for money.
Another thing I will say, if you're looking for a good blazer or a good suit, but you don't want to spend a lot of money, go on like the RealReal or something and look for like old like Donna Karan. Look for Jill Sander. Look for Calvin Klein. All of those brands are not worth that much right now.
They've figured out Jill Sander. They have not figured out Armani, old Calvin Klein, Donna Karan. You're right. Yeah, those things you can get for under $100, sometimes $50. Maybe it doesn't fit great. It's worth taking it to a tailor. You will actually have that forever.
Yeah, and if you want a boxier blazer, just get a men's blazer and then get it tailored.
After this internship, will you call us back and tell us, like, what does Big actually do?
Hi, Chelsea and Lauren. I'm a really big fan of your show. Calling to say some gossip about one of your favorites, Isabelle Huppert. I'm from Paris, and just last week we had a really big controversy with Isabelle here, because she was playing a very well-respected theater here, a play called Berenice, and she was just humiliated on stage. A guy just stand up in the middle of the piece and started yelling, "Isabelle, we don't understand a thing you're saying," and people just start laughing around. As a true professional, she just kept on going. All the newspapers and everybody is talking about this here.
Okay, so this call has a separate question, which we'll get into in a moment, but I just want to address this whole controversy, which I was unaware of, but there have been several articles written about this.
And we did receive several calls from French fuckettes being like, guys, you got to know what happens.
Which I absolutely love. Thank you for all the French fuckettes that called in. This is horrible. How dare anyone heckle our queen?
But she took it like a champ and kept going.
Of course she took it like a champ. You think, like, this is a job for the week? This bitch has lived through absolutely everything.
The play in question is an avant-garde interpretation by this Italian director named Romeo Castellucci, which I guess this is his thing of doing, like, very pared-down avant-garde productions. During one speech, I took this from an article I read, an audience member protested that they were struggling to hear Isabelle Huppert only to be told to shut up by others.
Yeah, that's basically what happened. The audience started fighting with each other. And it was about her performance, but also kind of about like how much of an audience reaction is appropriate in the middle of a play. I would have been livid if I was in the theater that someone interrupted the show. Well, also, if they're having audio issues, that's on the director. That's on the sound.
It's true. I was watching, for whatever reason, Jason Alexander has a podcast, and I've been getting clips on TikTok. I swear.
Excuse me?
I swear this is relevant. And he was talking about directing a play And he was talking to the sound guy and he was like, great, what mics do you want to use for the actors? And he was like, I've done hundreds of plays. I've never used a mic. They do a run through. He's sitting in the audience. He goes, oh my God, no one can hear the actors. And his point was like, in the 20 years since he's been on stage, directed a play, they just don't teach projection in the way that they used to.
But this bitch knows projection. I'm telling you, I have seen Isabelle Huppert in two plays, but I saw her in this play called Quartet, which was an interpretation of Dangerous Liaisons. And she was incredible, obviously, but it was kind of awkward because I went with my dad and it was like the most sexually explicit play I've ever seen. I just remember her screaming about rim jobs. And then I was like, oh, this is like very awkward.
So you've seen that and Eyes Wide Shut with your father.
Exactly. And I also saw her in The Maids and she was incredible. She's a seasoned theater actor. She understands projection. I don't believe that this is on her. If they didn't like the play, that's fine. We've all sat through plays that we think are fucking boring. But do you see me causing a scene at Shakespeare in the Park?
At one of the most tragic scenes in the play, they laughed.
I mean, it's definitely rude to Isabel. It's just hard to weigh in on this because we, of course, have not seen the play.
We must go to Paris now to see this play.
Visually, it looks amazing. She's been posting about it a lot on Instagram lately.
Let's go into the second part of this question.
And since I'm on the line, I just want to ask a question, a bridal question. So I'm marrying my partner in September. We're going to do like a small wedding in the Soho here in Paris. And I'm wondering what to wear because my partner is more like a Tatiana type, kind of a butch type. But I'm not as him as Chelsea, so I don't really know what to wear. And I wanted to wear like a white suit. And at the same time, I'm not really that comfortable with doing a scheme of like the bride and the groom, like going to the binary scheme of the things. I want you guys' opinion about that. And thank you. Bye.
Okay, first of all, congratulations. That's so exciting. I think you should dress however you want. Just because your partner is the more butch one doesn't mean that you should have to wear a dress just so everyone's gender presentation is sufficiently opposite. Like, you're already gay, so who gives a fuck? Also, I do feel you because while I have had femi periods, I'm not in one now. I mostly wear pants and blazers. If I wear a skirt, I usually wear a blazer. I get not wanting to feel like you're in drag, so I think that you should consider one of two options. Firstly, a cream suit with no shirt underneath is a great look for a woman. I can't help but think of the lesbian-coded Vogue editor from Romeo and Michelle's high school reunion. You could also do a skirt suit that's like more boxy and not like more of a Prada type look with like a Prada loafer or like maybe a low point toe kitten heel if you do feel like giving a little bit of like she her vibes, you know?
I always think that Bianca Jagger got married in a pantsuit, but it was actually a blazer and a relatively long skirt.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. The skirt has to be kind of wide and longer.
Yeah, because I couldn't get a beat on this call. It seemed like you wanted to wear a suit, which go ahead, but then also it felt like maybe you wanted to be present a little femme, so that's why I think Bianca Jagger is a great reference, who wore her white blazer at her wedding, had nothing underneath it as well.
I think that's always such a good look.
To veil or not veil?
I think a short veil is really cute with a skirt suit, although if you don't want to wear a dress, I don't think you want to wear a veil.
I saw on Pinterest this courthouse wedding where someone just had a piece of tulle that went over their eyes.
Yeah, that's chic. But also, I think if you want to kind of do a nod to the traditional like man-woman wedding dress, it's like you could be in a white suit and they could be in a black suit. It's bride and groom coded without the whole production. Don't wear a jumpsuit. That's my other thing.
Yeah.
Don't wear a wedding jumpsuit. Look, fuckettes that have gotten married in wedding jumpsuits, I'm not talking about you. I do think that they have had a moment and I do think that they work for some people, but I think that time has passed and I don't think a jumpsuit is the solution to a bride not wanting to dress like a Disney princess.
Too long, did read. Search Bianca Jagger's wedding outfit on Pinterest. It will then give you more modern suggestions and go from there.
Also, even like, this is more she, her, but like Stella Tennant's Helmut Lang wedding dress, it's a dress, but it's not girly in any way. Just putting that out there.
All right, send us pics.
Hi, Lauren. Hi, Chelsea. I recently got into an argument with one of my friends about the styling of Saltburn. I wanted to ask your take on how realistic style in Saltburn is of the mid-aughts. I was in middle school, so I am not like super familiar, but I felt like it was fairly accurate. And my friend went to college in suburban Illinois during that time, and she vehemently did not agree with me. So I was just like, for two experts to weigh in.
No, they are not historically accurate at all. Costumes were the weak link in Saltburn, in my opinion.
I mean, I think it's telling that most people didn't know Saltburn was a period piece from the trailer.
I didn't know it was a period piece until after I had watched the film.
We were in college when Saltburn takes place. However, we weren't living in England. But having said that, I was a tad shocked that there wasn't a single American Apparel bodysuit insights. I'm not sure if American Apparel had gotten to England by then.
It reminded me of the way that people are dressed in music videos.
Go on.
It was a lot of bright colors that all kind of worked together. It was all very trendy and all over the place. It was about rich people, but nobody actually looked rich or was wearing anything that like a rich person would wear. Like in that era.
There's a Stephen Frears film called The Grifters. He purposely made it so you couldn't tell what time period it took place in, where.
That's what I thought this was.
That's why I bring it up, is I thought the same thing. Like, those characters are driving cars from the 80s, but they're dressed kind of 60s influence, so you couldn't put your finger on it. Because the way that Jacob Elordi and Barry Keoghan are dressed in the early university scenes more look like a film that's set in the late 80s, early 90s.
I do think the costuming highlight is Jacob Elordi's angel outfit, which was like a gender-swapped version of Claire Danes's Romeo and Juliet angel vibes.
We got that reference. We love that reference. When we talk about the costumes being bad, we're not talking about that. But I remember this quote from the writer-director Emerald Fennell, where she was making a point of like, why did you set it 15 years ago? And she was like, well, anything 15 years in the past is just ugly. If that was her intention, I don't think she really committed to that, because if that were the case, Jacob Elordi would be wearing a button-down, a tie, with a cardigan. He would look like Andy Samberg his first year of SNL.
That's so true. I think she did that to solve the cell phone problem.
Yeah.
And also, for the film to end in the present day, it needs to have taken place in the past. Literally, I think costumes are my only criticism of that movie. I thought that was a very enjoyable film. I would watch it again.
Yeah. My other point with the costuming is, the sister character would be wearing like a dress over a pair of skinny jeans, like she's Sienna Miller or something.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Zuleika. I'm calling because this just popped into my head. I am obsessed with an old feud. It's so random. It's a feud between Clay Aiken and Kelly Ripa. I do not know why it stays with me all these years. I don't even watch Live with Kelly and whoever it is now. But do you know what I'm talking about? And what do you think?
I have often identified my favorite genre of calls when we do hotline episodes. This has just entered a new genre I love. If fuckettes would like to call about pop cultural moments from the recent past to be like, do you remember this? Let's talk about it a little bit. More of these. Of course we remember this.
Yeah, thanks for bringing up my Roman Empire.
So for those who don't know what this is, do you want to explain it, Chelsea?
Clay Aiken was filling in for Regis Philbin on, wait, what's that show called?
Regis and Kelly?
On Regis and Kelly. They were interviewing people from Dancing with the Stars. At one point, Clay Aiken put his hand over Kelly Ripa's mouth, like as a comedic bit.
To signal she was going on too long. Perhaps she was hogging the interview. And then when she got his hand off of her mouth, she said, also trying to be comedic, well, I don't know where that hand's been.
Cut to The View the next day. They play the clip on The View, and Rosie O'Donnell is like, I think that was homophobic. She basically said, like, if he was straight and if he was hot, she wouldn't have cared. everyone else on the panel kind of disagreed with her. And then I guess Kelly Ripa was watching this live, called in. They patched in her call to the live show. And her and Rosie basically like got into a fight because she was like, I wasn't being homophobic. I just don't think it's appropriate for someone to put their hands on your face.
We have a segment of those. We can play it now.
To me, it never even occurred to me that that would be. And I apologize to you if you felt that way. What I'm saying is, regardless of whatever the sexual orientation is, it was outrageous. It was out of line. It was unprofessional. And he wouldn't have done it to you.
What is lost in this audio clip versus the visual is Rosie O'Donnell is stone cold silent. You can clearly see she does not agree with this at all. This was so big, it went everywhere. But there's even more backstory, Chelsea, because when I was researching this, this is a segment taken out of Ladies Who Punch, which was the story behind The View.
My favorite book.
So Rosie O'Donnell tells this story that he had come into my dressing room crying about whether or not to come out, and I sat down with him and I talked to him. I hugged him. Not only do I feel the 20 years older mother thing, I feel the 20 years older younger gay thing. So I just held a crying boy and then watched him be gay bashed by Kelly Ripa. Here's what's interesting is Clay Aiken's side of that conversation is the complete opposite, where basically he says that Rosie O'Donnell took him backstage and was like, you need to find yourself a boyfriend in North Carolina and live peacefully there. And I said, you're very presumptuous, Rosie. We should also say this was an era where Clay Aiken was not out and everyone was sort of like, what's going on there? There was a lot of questions about his sexuality.
Yeah, so Rosie O'Donnell essentially outed him on The View in coming to his defense, which leads me to believe that she already thought that Kelly Ripa was homophobic for some other reason. I think this reaction sort of goes beyond just being, you know, highly attuned to homophobia and wanting to defend Clay Aiken. I think that it was easy for her to think of Kelly Ripa as being homophobic for whatever reason. That said, I am definitely on Kelly's side of this feud. As much as I love Rosie O'Donnell, I don't think you should just put your hand on someone's face, especially because, as she said, she had just seen him shaking hands with the entire audience.
That's right. Because then the day after that, Regis is back, and this is how she describes the situation.
There was some impropriety there, and there's a lack of respect. And when you're a certain person, you're in the public eye, you have to be respectful of other people. And I don't think that he was respectful in any way. And I will, you know, if that upsets his fans, I'm sorry to hear that. But, you know, you don't put your hands over somebody's face and mouth when they're conducting an interview, even if it's for a laugh. And that's all I'm going to say.
Okay, but Sherry Shepherd made the point. I fucking love Sherry, by the way. Sherry was like, he wouldn't have done it to Regis, which actually I agree with.
Also, it's the opposite, right? Which is everyone is like, well, Clay Aiken wouldn't have done that if it were Regis. And it's sort of this impulse as if like Kelly Ripa wouldn't have said that if Regis put his hand over her mouth. It's just bad interviewing 101.
And Clay Aiken, it goes without saying, is not a professional in the way that Kelly Ripa and Regis, of course, are. But I think when someone says, I don't know where your hands have been, they should take that as face value. Whereas Rosie took it to mean his hands aren't clean because he's been jerking off someone's dick is what is implied, right?
Or his fist has been in someone's ass? Like, I don't...
No, literally.
Yeah, it's far worse.
Look, I love Rosie O'Donnell. I hate to like disagree with her on any level because she is like my ultimate queen. I think even she in retrospect might be like, maybe I shouldn't have gone that hard. Yeah, I've never been a huge Kelly Ripa fan, but I do respect her for her appearance on Broad City. She played herself. It was incredible.
Well, I, of course, always love Kelly Ripa's performance in Harper's Bazaar, What I Eat in a Day, which has
been
scrubbed from the internet, where she says that she does not eat chewing foods before 11 a.m.
Hi, Chelsea and Lauren. First of all, I love you so much. Second of all, I'm high, so I might be whispering. But I just needed to let you both know that I went thrifting today in the great state of Massachusetts, and I found a John Galliano newspaper sweatshirt. At first I picked it up because I thought it was Reputation Taylor Swift merch, And then I looked at it and I said, this is the ugliest thing I've ever seen. And then I looked at the tag and it said John Galliano. And I said, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And I bought it. And I just want to say that I would have never known who John Galliano if it wasn't for you two. Also, did I mention that it was $25? Because it was $25.
Thank you for sharing this beautiful story. I died at the I thought it was reputation merch part. That was really, really beautiful.
I thought of you when I heard that part too. Look, your fashion moms are very proud of you. We're also a bit jealous.
Yeah, this is a great thing to find in a thrift store. This is what you dream of. And to give a little bit of context, so the Dior newsprint textile debuted in the Hobo Chic Couture collection that I think that was 2000.
Yes.
It then trickled into the ready-to-wear. And then John Galliano also had his own eponymous label. And at some point, he just started doing newsprint stuff too. So the newsprint really like stretched into every aspect of his brand and also the design of his Diptyque candle, which has tragically been redesigned. And that's something that really breaks me.
But does it still smell, as my mother once called it, like church, which is her favorite smell?
It still smells great. That is an incredible candle, by the way. Highly recommend. I just miss when it had that John Galliano newsprint.
We should say, and I don't want to rain on your parade, but what you have is slightly different than the Carrie Bradshaw newsprint dress. That is the Christian Dior newsprint that he did, not to be confused with the newsprint, as Chelsea explained, that John Galliano himself did. However,
still iconic.
Still iconic, but also I looked on eBay and First Dibs, and those go for $300, $500. So you got that for a steal. If you want to make a buck, you could flip it on First Dibs. Also, where are you going? Can we make a little mini trip where we go up to Massachusetts and do some thrifting? That also made me cry. There's nowhere in the larger Los Angeles area, let alone the state of California, where you could find anything like that for less than $1,000.
Well, it's also just because like now so many Gen Z people are going to thrift stores, like they're so picked over now, you might as well just shop online. Also, related note, I was so excited. I found a Balenciaga newsprint dress on The RealReal recently. I'll have to wear it at one of our shows. And then I was looking for more of that newsprint stuff, and I found a men's shirt for like nothing, bought it for Tat. So I'm going to force her into a very crazy couple's look.
I can't wait.
Anywho, next call.
Hi, Lauren. Hi, Chelsea. This is Sonia from Kansas City. I'm watching season 4, episode 13, The Good Fight. And I just wanted to know if you two had any moving advice for moving in with your partner. And also if you think that Carrie and Aiden moved in too quickly, because I don't really understand why Aiden just moved all of his shit over to Carrie's apartment. Like, can we talk about some of the logistics just like for my own mental health?
Let's talk about the logistics for my own mental health as well. No, do you want to tackle the moving in with a partner?
Well, I live with a girl, so it's all very chill, you know? It's not like I'm dealing with stuff like it's like, oh, he leaves his like gross deodorants out. I live with someone that is very clean, orderly, and has excellent taste. Although sometimes she leaves her fuckboy clothes all over our bedroom, which is where her closet is. So I'm tripping over like Champion hoodies and Supreme boxers and shit.
Another determining factor is, are they moving into your place? Are you moving into their place? Or are you both moving into a new place together?
Yeah, because if it's someone moving into someone else's place, like the new person is a victim.
I think a way to lessen the victimhood is to make the experience as mutual as possible. So I think it's a good opportunity for the both of you to thin out your stuff. When Paul was moving in, it really awakened the spring cleaning I had put off for literal years. He also thinned out stuff as well. But at least you're starting from a point where you're both already putting in the work to make cohabitating as chill as possible.
I think the worst part about it, though, is merging the furniture, which I didn't have to deal with Tat because I moved from New York to LA with pretty much just my clothes and my book collection and, you know, some artwork and stuff like that. And then she moved from Australia with no furniture, basically just clothes. So we got to pick out all that stuff gradually together. But when you have two vastly different apartments that have to then merge, you gotta sell some stuff and get some new stuff.
Paul similarly moved across country with no furniture. So that was kind of a non-starter. He was moving in.
Very similarly to me, as we lived on the same street.
For those who don't understand what we're talking about, when I first met Paul, he lived across the street from Chelsea's apartment.
Shout out to Stockholm Street.
Yeah, I guess you can dox it now. That was the other weird thing, is he was like, I don't have much. And I was like, yeah, like we all say we don't have much, but truly, he didn't have a ton of clothing either.
Well, men just like don't.
That's true. I was also gonna say, and this is really obvious, but communication is key, obviously. And I feel like just because you're cohabitating with someone doesn't mean that you have to give up certain rituals that you have. Like, obviously, my default setting was being alone. I'm an only child. I lived alone pretty much my entire life. So I will sometimes, not often, but sometimes I will just look at Paul and go, I need only child time. And what that means is...
That's what Carrie did to Aiden.
Exactly. But I go into the bedroom and I listen to music for 30 minutes and then I come back out and I'm reset.
I guess I have enough alone time because I work from home and my partner works outside of the home and travels. So I think that's built in.
I don't know how realistic this advice is going to be, but... if you can make a space for your partner where they can do things and like make a mess somewhere else, like we converted a garage into Paul's office and workspace. And I think that saved us from a lot of fights.
That's also like LA having a spare garage privilege.
I understand it might not be the most relatable, but there's so many factors. Do you both work from home? Is it a one bedroom? Which is, I think, a great transition into the Carrie and the Aiden of it all. So I believe that Aiden moved his shit in because they believe that that old lady, you know, the old lady who had an apartment behind Carrie's that just was invented in season 4, that she was going to move out immediately. And I think that's why he moved his stuff in, because they were just going to put his stuff in the other apartment as a storage unit. But having gone a home renovation myself, I'm not sure how Aiden thought he was going to renovate and connect two apartments on his own while living in one of those spaces.
That was always crazy.
She needed to get that storage unit that she hadn't in just like that.
The one that's bigger than her actual apartment?
Correct.
Okay, so I want to institute a new tradition on our hotline episodes, which is that we play the most unhinged call last.
All right.
Hey guys, this is Liz, longtime listener, first time caller, and I'm basically calling because I don't have anybody else to tell this. So I'm listening to The Daily about, you know, Putin killing this guy and just all the background and stuff. And there's a point in there where he's giving a speech and he basically says, Basiba, which of course I know because Carrie asked her waxing lady a couple of words in Russian while she was with Petrovsky. So I just want to say, hashtag impact, that show lives forever, helps us function in the world. Okay, bye, love y'all.
I mean, basically, she's saying, like, from Sex and the City, I learned thank you in Russian.
I would say that this woman is crazy, but it's like we all have our own version of this, right? And it really does speak to, if you've watched these episodes over and over for years, these little details are just permanently part of you.
Yeah, and it comes out at the oddest times. Sometimes it's the grocery store. Sometimes it's when you're listening to The Daily.
But I very much appreciated this call because, yes, the impact that this show has and will always have.
This mental illness we justify as having crucial things in our lives. Like, no. It doesn't matter how many family memories I've deleted so that I can remember all of Carrie's boyfriends in chronological order.
Seriously, that. How do I not remember anything from my own life? Yet, I remember Carrie Bradshaw's life so vividly.
It is crazy that in the 6 years of Sex and the City, we never met Carrie's mother once, but we've seen Carrie at the waxers twice.
You know what? That could be a crazy end just like that reveal. The reveal of Carrie's mom. Can you imagine?
So Carrie's mom didn't come to her wedding, didn't come to Big's funeral. Big's imaginary brother, who didn't exist until that funeral episode, we've seen, but not Carrie's mother. Give up the dream. We're never getting Carol Kane as Sarah Jessica Parker's mother.
But we should. Bette Midler's a veil.
We're not going to get it. I honestly, at this point, I think everything that we say we want to happen is purposely not going to happen.
Also, I'm sure there's nothing that Bette Midler would rather do less than have to play Sarah Jessica Parker's mother. But it would complete the trilogy of their projects together. First Wives Club, Hocus Pocus, and Just Like That, season 3.
All right, guys. This has been fun.
This has been very fun.
Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.